It wasn't that long ago that it was a dream for blind people to be able to have access to their daily newspaper. Now, thanks to organisations such as the Talking Newspaper Association of the United Kingdom, blind people are getting access to the full text of major dailies before sighted people get them in their hands. To tell us about that, we're joined by the Managing Director of the Talking Newspaper Association of the United Kingdom, Tim MacDonald. Tim MacDonald from the Talking Newspaper Association of the United Kingdom, welcome to Main Menu. It's great to have you along.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask you about the origins, first of all, of this service. How long have you been around for, and how did it get started?
The service basically started in 1970. It started in North Wales, in Aberystwyth, where a librarian, a senior librarian up there called Ronald Sturt, had been sent over to Sweden to see how libraries handled the questions of disability. And while over there, he'd seen a group of people around a tape recorder and asked what they were doing. And they said, oh, when people come into the library, want an item from the newspaper, we just simply record it for them and give it to them. And that was the basis of the idea. He mentioned it back in Aberystwyth to a group of businessmen who said, what a superb idea. Promptly pulled out a checkbook there and then, wish I could find those people now, and said, you know, here's the money, could you go ahead and do something similar? And that was the start of it. And in January 1970, the Cardiganshire Talking Newspaper began. Somebody else found out about that and started up their own. And it rolled on from then. To the result, we now have 540 local talking newspapers throughout the United Kingdom. And then in 1984, somebody said, well, we're doing all the local newspapers. Why don't we do the national as well? So that's when the national service started.
So has there always been this association that's kind of bound them all together, or was that a progressive thing?
That was a progressive thing. They went for about 4 years, with each local talking newspaper helping another one. And in about 1974, I think there was something like 25, 26 local talking newspapers, and that's when it was decided that an association of some kind, a forum which would promote the idea of local talking newspapers and help existing papers and new ones to form as well, that's when it started.
There's a bit of variation in terms of the way that these tapes are presented. I'm staggered by how many there are in Britain, and some of them I've heard are almost like mini radio programs. You know, they have jingles and all sorts of things. Others are a bit more formal, as in just a few narrators reading material. Do you have guidelines that members of the association must follow?
Not so much guidelines, because in fact each local talking newspaper is in fact a separate autonomous charity. They are their own bosses. They're merely affiliated to the association who gives them guidance. But some of them are, shall we say, without being rude, a little parochial. They're well-meaning people who get together perhaps in somebody's sitting room or maybe at the back of a church hall, and they'll record for about 20, 25 people. Others would put most professional radio stations to shame. They have magnificent studios. They perhaps have up to 90 people working there, and they're serving anything up to 800, 900, even 1,000 visually impaired people. Some will do simply extracts from the local paper. Others will also put on their own home-produced news magazine, entertainment magazine, which is of an extraordinary high standard.
I'm intrigued that, given the popularity of the talking newspapers, there are no radio reading services that I'm aware of in the United Kingdom.
There are moves to start it. There is, in fact, a move to begin a radio for blind people. But the thing is that the whole thing about talking newspapers, I'd love to be able to actually use the word unique, rather than, as we keep saying, well, we're almost unique, quite unique. No, things are unique. And in terms of the scope and the range of what we do, we are a newspaper. We are like the high street news agent for visually impaired people. So we're not as such a radio, although there's talk about maybe expanding the service into a kind of radio-type format. But we are the people who, as it were, deliver your newspaper through your front door. It's a very personal service. And indeed, with the national service which is now operating electronically as well, we are actually in the situation where we now have visually impaired people receiving and browsing their daily newspapers quicker than sighted people. It's that sort of degree of immediacy.
Yeah, let's move on to that, because obviously our audience is an internet audience listening to this. I was absolutely startled and delighted to stumble across the website that you have and the services that you offer. And one of the nice things for those of us who are not in Britain is that you don't seem to place any restrictions on who is eligible for the service, provided that they are legitimately blind or vision impaired, whereas a lot of the US services will only do US subscribers. So that's a nice feature.
The beauty about the electronic service, of course, is that it did break down barriers. Quite right. The one restriction we do require is evidence that people are visually impaired. This is understandable for copyright reasons. We explain to publishers and producers of material that we are not infringing in any way on their legitimate rights. We're not taking away custom from them, because the people we are delivering the material to, they cannot access, obviously, the normal written material. Strictly speaking, in this country, it is something which producers of material should be taking into account themselves. But we say to them, well, if you won't do it yourself, then we'll do it, but with the guarantee that we will try to ensure that the people who receive it have this genuine handicap, this disability, and that way they've got the same access, hopefully, or very nearly the same access as a sighted person.
Yes, as we record this, it is the day after the strikes began on Afghanistan, and I have the latest version of the Guardian on my Braille note here, and reading that with great interest, because you get much more in-depth analysis. It's good stuff. Tell us a little bit about how it works, what's on offer, and the different ways in which people can access that material.
Right, the way it works, so without getting too technical, is that we pick up the information from a news service. Now, people say, that's fine, anybody can do that, but the answer there, or the reply to that is, yes, but it's extremely difficult to get around. So what we have developed is a program which takes this material, it strips out graphical and pictorial material, it then glues together an article, which would by necessity be separate in its original format, because it might have been around a picture or around a caption or something else. We've also got the infamous continued on page 2, column 3 syndrome. Having, as it were, glued all the items back together again, it separately indexes them with a brief summary of what each article contains. And that's how a visually impaired person can actually get around the newspaper relatively easily. Now, you can access it if you want, obviously, for your daily newspapers, you want it on the day. Now, you can either access it through a bulletin board, or we can send it to you on an email. Or if you're not too worried about getting it immediately, for example, if it's a weekly or monthly magazine of a particular interest to you, then we can send it to you on a floppy, or the most common of all is on the CD-ROM. Now, the CD-ROM will give you up to 11 newspapers, all 6 days editions, plus the Sunday papers and the supplements, what's on radio, what's on television, selection of weekly, selection of monthly titles, plus a selection of titles from the Gutenberg Book Project as well.
And that CD comes out weekly, does it?
CD comes out weekly, yes.
Hmm. How much does it cost to access the service?
Variety of tariffs. There are different rates if you take the analog, the cassette service, depending on how many you take. You know, if it's 1 to 3 titles, for example, it'll be either £30 or £45, and it's graded up from there. However, for the electronic service, it is simply, we offer, I say, this choice of two tariffs, what we call a concessionary rate or a standard rate, which is closer to our actual production costs. The concessionary rate is £30. The standard rate is £45. If you want the CD-ROM, which I say is like having a mini library sent to you, then that's only £90, and that's annual rates.
That's extremely reasonable, really. I presume that there are donations as well as the subscriptions that are helping to keep the service up and running?
We are only just, to be absolutely honest, able to keep up and running. It costs us not far short of £1 million a year to run this service. We have a mixture of paid staff and volunteers. Volunteers are invaluable because without them there is no way we'll be able to run it. We have been looking to try and get some kind of government assistance, particularly the present government with its much acclaimed policy of social inclusion. We were not very pleased to be turned down with the appalling reason that we don't support leisure activities.
Oh, goodness
now,
gracious.
For people who use this service and regard it as a lifeline, I think that was unintentionally desperately insulting. We are going back to explain to the powers that be that we are slightly more than the leisure service.
One would wonder how some of those decision makers would feel about not being able to read their newspaper every morning.
That's exactly the point, which we said. I wrote back to one senior minister and said, may I come in and take all your papers, all your magazines, everything off your desk? I will then come back in a month's time and ask you whether you still think information such as is found in the press, such as is found in periodicals, whether you still think it's a leisure activity.
I mean, there is a very senior minister in the UK government who is blind and presumably wants to know what the papers are saying about his performance. I take it that's not much help.
No, it's not.
That's a shame.
I won't go any further on that one, but no, the gentleman in question hasn't been able to offer much in the way of practical help.
That is a shame. What other expansions or improvements are you looking at? One suggestion I thought I might bend your ear on was that, of course, if you make Braille files available, BRF files that are usable in a Braille note taker, they would actually be a little smaller because Grade 2 Braille takes up fewer characters than regular ASCII. Is that an option that you've considered?
The whole question of Braille, actually, we've kept off. Although, in fact, through the electronic service, you can actually, if you have a Brailler at the receiving end, you can actually, the screen reader will convert it into Braille for you.
Yes.
But and in terms of actually, at this end, having anything directly to do with Braille, no, this is more National Library for the Blind and other organizations who handle that side. We're more concerned, really, with just, as it were, transmitting stuff out, so electronically. How it is picked up, we do tend to leave that to the individual, who in turn will get in touch with other organizations.
Yeah, it is good to see that they do come as a zip file on the email, because uncompressed, the full Guardian, the daily newspaper, could be about 600 or 700K. I mean, there's a lot of reading there. And you don't offer the ads, I notice.
No, we don't. I'm actually trying to get around that. There are two reasons. One, more seriously, is that a number of publishers won't supply the ads. Now, this again, we're checking to see whether this is in contravention of the Disability Discrimination Act, but it actually just doesn't come through. Another case where we do get it through is that it presents our staff in the IT department with horrendous problems. A lot of graphic material is mixed in with what appears to be straight printing, straight copy. And unfortunately, our program tends to make mincemeat of it, and we do end up with a lot of gobbledygook. It is something we're addressing, and without going into too much detail, a lot of this stems from a breakdown of disciplines within the publishing and printing industry, as a result of which we're about to become the first members of the Institute of Printing, actually taking print to visually impaired people. And the printing industry is actually quite interested in this, because obviously our problems are something which most printers never even remotely think about. But in order to get the correct visual impact on the printed page, a number of strange things are going on. I'm very fortunate having a man amongst my staff called Jerry Danson, who it was only after I took him on I realized this man apparently was a legend in the British printing industry. Mm. And he's certainly been doing a lot of intriguing work on OCR, optical character recognition. And he's been using his contacts in the printing industry to point out that the strange problems we're having. But this does, in fact, impinge back onto advertising, because it does throw up an enormous number of technical problems.
I guess there are some people who are happy to have them, but of course, when you don't have access to ads, they suddenly become quite a legitimate form of information, don't they? You know, it's a funny thing.
They do, and especially the classified ads
are
extremely important. Now, one of our trustees is a chap called Vidar Jading, who, in spite of his Norwegian name, is English. His job, he's actually political correspondent of Carlton Television. Now, he got that job through an ad which we carried on one of our publications. He takes 17 of our national publications. And although he's been totally blind since the age of 9, he knew more about news and current affairs than any of his sighted competitors for the job. So here's a classic case amongst one of our own trustees of somebody who achieved a pretty impressive career solely through sponsorship, or rather subscription to talking newspapers.
That's a fantastic testimony, really. What impact has the internet had on the degree to which people are subscribing? I just noticed that there are quite a few comprehensive news-based websites run by newspapers in the United Kingdom. Has that had a detrimental effect?
Not that we are aware. Again, it is this question of navigation. A number of websites, not just news sites, but other sites as well, they're difficult enough to get around if you're sighted. If you don't have sight, they are lethal. There's very little way you can get around them. And again, a number of news sites aren't necessarily the most user-friendly. Now, the whole point about our service is the format in which it goes out. And indeed, we're working on this the whole time to make it even simpler. And we're now looking, not so much to the internet, but again, coming back to home use, certainly the use of personal digital assistants. And some of the work which is going on now, we're beginning to see the day of handheld gizmos, which will be voice-operated and will be absolutely ideally suited to somebody who can't see. The whole thing will just operate off voice instruction, even to the extent that we now think that you'll be able to have your news read to you in a voice of your choice. This will be from voice sampling. There's still a long way to go on that. But we're even talking about things like that. Now, that is such an easy access. This is the sort of thing that we feel certain that, and certainly our blind subscribers, those we've asked, feel this is the sort of thing they'd be very interested in.
When you decide to publish or make available a publication, what determines that decision, and conversely, what determines when you no longer carry a particular publication?
Almost entirely requests. This is how it, right from the word go. There was a curious rule in the early days of talking newspapers that if more than 12 people requested a title, it went on. This is one of the reasons why we've ended up with 8 gardening magazines, and at one point we had 4 dog magazines. Obviously they were the most vociferous sort of people who had an interest in these subjects. It's basically down to the demand. We know, obviously, month by month how the figures go, and just recently we have taken a couple of titles off when one of the electronic cases, nobody at all was subscribing. Another thing on the electronic side which determines it is ease of what I should call preparation or editing. Some of the magazines come to us in a bit of a mess, and it requires an enormous amount of time, sheer manual hours, to actually put it into a format in which the auto part of it will then take over. Certain magazines or certain newspapers, no trouble at all, and the whole thing can be automated almost from the word go. Now, obviously, something which requires very little manual input will probably take precedent over something where I know I've got to devote, say, 6 hours of one of my staff's time to getting it ready for that auto stage.
And do you have a rule that they must be British publications? I noticed that you've got some very, shall we say, prestigious publications there, such as The Economist and The New Scientist, but nothing from the US, such as Time magazine, for instance.
We don't have Time magazine on electronically, but we do have Time on our analog.
Okay, right.
But that, again, the trouble with the analog is that you are restricted to the length of a C90 tape, so it can only be extracts.
And so for the electronic publications, is that just because it's easier to source them from the UK? Is that why they're not there, or is it a resource thing, really?
At the moment, it is a resource. It is ease of access. It is much easier to access stuff produced in this country. The other thing which is becoming a very, very serious topic in the digital age is the question of copyright. Now, there's just been a huge debate in the European Parliament, and the European Copyright Directive has just been passed. That is now being discussed by individual governments. Copyright holders are getting extremely nervous in the digital age because fundamentally just opens up their property to everybody. I won't go into it now because it's long and complex, and we'll probably be discussing the topic 24 hours from now. But there is a move to try and bring in licenses so that anybody who wants to do the sort of work we're doing will have to apply for a license. Now, what we're saying is no. there is a freedom of access. There is a right of access. And if a sighted person has ready access to a source of reading material, then so should somebody with a visual impairment. Don't license the agency doing it, because fundamentally what you're doing, you're trying to license the user. And we put it extremely bluntly. And we said, if, for example, tomorrow you said that all Jews or all gays were going to have a license before they could access your material, it would be headline news, and rightly so. The implication by saying that agencies trying to make material accessible for an impaired, visually impaired person, if they've got to have a license as well, what you're fundamentally saying is that you're visually impaired, you must have a license to access our material. Now, they're not actually saying that, but that is, I think, an unavoidable implication. So there are some fairly heavy-duty discussions going on at the moment. It does make people a little nervous about making their material available electronically, and this does, to a certain extent, include from the States as well.
Yeah, it's a really difficult issue, because I think that our accessibility issues are not as easily understood as, for example, putting a ramp up beside a building. And in 1994, incidentally, New Zealand was the first country to pass a copyright law that said that if you were putting material into a format so that it can be accessed by a person with a print disability, that you didn't need copyright clearance. And there have been some other countries who have emulated that since, but it doesn't seem to be heading in that direction in Europe. In fact, the whole thing, digital rights management, seems to be going the other way, more restrictions being imposed.
Indeed, the lobbying that went on with the European Copyright Directive, the original request was draconian. There would have been no freedom of access at all without getting permission, applying for licenses and all the rest. Now, this is bad enough for talking books, where you may delay a book by a week, 2 weeks, whatever. It's an inconvenience, little more than that. But as I pointed out with talking newspapers, it completely jeopardizes our whole operation. Because if we're delayed just by a few hours, our product becomes obsolete. We have got to have the right to go in. We will respect people's copyright. We always acknowledge sources. We make it clear that we're doing this with the permission of the rights holders. But that's supplied in the analog age. But with the digital age, and particularly where, in fact, the right holder can block access to the material, obviously the implications are much broader. So this is an ongoing discussion. Having said that, rights holders are talking. We've spoken with publishers, with periodical publishers. I've been up talking to government representatives. And I think in Britain, in England certainly, there will be legislation within the year that will make it quite clear what organisations like us, and indeed educational organisations and libraries, there will be a freedom of access to a certain degree, and I think we will get to it. At the moment, we're still negotiating.
Is there a coalition of producers of this sort of material working in Britain to safeguard and even improve their rights?
Oh, masses of them. One might say there's probably too many. For example, I attend something that is done under the auspices of the Royal National Institute for the Blind, and it's called the Copyright Roundtable. For the European discussions, there was something called FPIC, which was, I never quite knew what it meant, European Fair Practice and Copyright Convention. And this was a consortium of colleges, libraries, universities, and indeed equipment manufacturers as well. So, yes, there are plenty of high-powered bodies, but there's a lot of talking, a lot of detail, and, yes, there's a lot of rocket science involved in it as well. It's extremely complex, as you can well imagine.
Indeed. Users of your service then clearly have an obligation, to put it quite bluntly, to behave themselves and not disseminate this information elsewhere.
Absolutely true. But this would apply, it's no more of a requirement than would be wanted from a sighted person. Simply respect copyright. It's there. It's for your use. Obviously, other people will see it. We can't avoid that in the same way that you've got a book. Somebody has got to borrow that book. But at the end of the day, it's simply respect the copyright. It is somebody's intellectual copyright. It's somebody's way of earning their living at the end of the day. And that's something we've made it absolutely clear. We are fully in support of right holders and their fight against piracy. But please don't assume that every visually impaired person is somehow going to be engaged in a form of piracy, which again is one of the unintentional implications of some of the arguments being put forward by rights holders.
Do you think there may come a time then where your organisation and others might have to use the DAISY format, which could in itself have some sort of digital rights management technology built in that may appease the copyright holders who are getting concerned?
We are in as part of the DAISY consortium already. Yes, but again, the whole point, the Royal National Institute for the Blind have always worked off a specialised system, which has gone some way to appeasing rights holders' fears. But it's not just the question of accessibility, it's the technique and the procedures being used to create the files. And rights holders are nervous that even sort of temporary files are being created as a necessary part of the system. And that comes under copyright as well. So you keep getting deeper and deeper into the mire, and everywhere you turn, somebody says, ah, yes, well, you've got a file here. Now, there's an interesting one which threw up the differences. So we involved in conversation with publishers. For example, the publisher said, please do not hold information on a storage system which can be accessible by a third party. For talking books in this country, they had no real qualms going along with that. But, of course, that strikes at the very heart of our electronic service. It is exactly how we operate. We keep our specially edited files on a storage system and on a bulletin board, outside party, albeit controlled through a password, come in to access that information if they want to download it to read that particular publication. So I had to say to the publishers, I'm sorry, I know it may seem a reasonable requirement, but we can't operate under that restriction. So there's scratching of heads and said, well, we'll talk about it further. And there were all sorts of other things which came up in the requirements. For example, going back to ordinary analog recording, the publishers said we only want single voice recording. For talking books, that was no problem, because they will send a book out to an actor or a reader who in their own time they will read that book. In this country, talking newspapers tend to use teams of four to read a newspaper. Here at the National Service, we use two. So I said, your requirement that we can only use single voice recordings, I can't go along with it. And this sort of went on down the line. So there was a sort of shrug of the shoulders, and as I said, they said, well, we'll discuss this further down the line. But it does mean that it's going to be an ongoing process of consultation.
Oh, you've got a bit of a rocky road to traverse, it sounds like.
Oh, it keeps me occupied, yes.
Just one final question before we sum up and talk about where people can find you. Synergies between your audio and your internet technologies, have you ever thought, for those people who would like to be read to by a human voice, putting your recordings up on the web so that people can stream them and hear them that way on something like RealPlayer or Windows Media Player?
Yes, indeed. In fact, we've had a couple of companies down here talking to us who are prepared to help us. Unfortunately, it will always come down to money. At the moment, I barely have enough cash to keep me going on a day-to-day basis. I've been in this job now just over 2 years. When I took over the job of chief executive in October 99, I was confronted with an organization which was in the most horrendous financial state you can imagine. We were so far the wrong side of the financial plimsoll line, it just wasn't true. I've managed to reverse that, so we are sitting at least with something of a surplus, but very, very little. I still have to consolidate our present operations. What I'm looking for and would love is if somebody could come along and provide good, solid, bedrock financial support. Now, if that can be done, then all of these possibilities, further ways of disseminating and distributing the work that we do here, we can now take this on as a major project and get it out, because anything which makes access to news, current affairs, easier for visually impaired people, obviously we want to pursue. But it will always come back to money. We are a very small charity. And if people came to see where we're based in a very, very nice East Sussex town, which is miles from anywhere. Our nearest railway station is about 15 miles away. I think the coach and four comes through once a week. We always joke about it. It is isolated, it is small, and we are running, I say, on a very small budget. But if we can get the money right, then all of these ideas, all of these projects which you've discussed in this conversation, yes, we can pursue with reality and pursue with vigor.
Well, current affairs are certainly uppermost in people's minds at the moment, and if people wish to find out more and look at subscribing to the various services you have on offer, how can people get in touch?
Right. Through the website, which is www.tnauk.org.uk.
Okay.
Our telephone number is 01435 866 102.
Right.
Now, from America, I'm not quite certain what the code will be on the front of that.
I think they dial 011 and then a double four and they drop your first zero. But anyway, they'll get it sorted out, I'm sure.
That's why. Otherwise, if you want to write to us, we are TNAUK, which stands for the Talking Newspaper Association of the United Kingdom, National Recording Centre, Browning Road, and that's Browning as in the poet, Heathfield, all one word, East Sussex, TN, Tommy Nuts, 218 DB. DB, dog's breakfast.
Well, you know, I just can't speak highly enough of the service that you're offering. I'm really thrilled that you've been able to give up this time to have a chat to us, and I hope that we can keep in touch and that the service continues to prosper.
Indeed, it's been a great pleasure talking to you, and just check in and see exactly what we do. I think you'd be very surprised.